Good evening, and thanks for tuning into KGNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins, and beyond at kgnu.org. This is Hemispheres and the Middle East Dialogues for December 27th, 2022. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, for this evening's Hemispheres. As always, joining me in these discussions are Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince. We are taping this program over Zoom due to my holiday plans, which have taken me out of Colorado and to the East Coast. So I want to thank Rob Prince for taping this program a day early. So thank you, Rob. And I also want to welcome back Ibrahim Kazrouni from his trip to Iraq and Iran to visit family. And I'm glad he's back safely. And welcome back, Ibrahim, as well. So welcome to both of you to the program.
Glad to be back.
Good. And let's begin. Rob, I think you're going to begin.
So we're really fortunate that Ibrahim on this program has just returned from 6 weeks in the Middle East, specifically in Iran and in Iraq. And he's going to share with us some of his impressions of what he has seen and what he's experienced there, some of which was personal, but some of which, needless to say, he got an interesting sense of how things are looking there. Now, look, over the last few months, the Western media here in the United States has been reporting on large-scale protests sweeping Iran against the hijab in the wake of the death of Mahsa Amini. The protests were described by some journalists as a revolution against the Islamic Republic and have been highlighted by a movement led by young women. Is this true? Is this a revolution? How much of this is part of essentially just another major media disinformation campaign? So before we get into that part of the discussion, Ibrahim, tell us a little bit about your trip.
Well, first of all, thank you, both of you, for organizing this, Jim and you, Rob. The trip originally started for personal reason because my mother is ill and I had to go to find out what I could do regarding her medical issue. But the six weeks gave me the opportunity, both in Iraq and Iran, to look deeper into the crisis that we constantly hear in the West, the Western media, as Rob, you alluded to, regarding sweeping revolt against the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So before we go on, I would like to put one thing straightforward. To be able to assess what is going on in Iran and what is going on in Iraq, these two countries that I visited, I think we have to dispense with all the narratives that exist in the Western media. Otherwise, we will have some kind of skewed mindset trying to establish what's going on. Through all this narratives that we have regarding, nothing is further from the truth. There is no revolution against the Islamic Revolution, against the government in Iran. There is no protest against that's not the one that I saw. And I traveled from the north to the south. I did not see any revolt. I did not see any protest. I did not see any huge number of people coming out against the government. Far from it. On occasions, I saw a huge number of people protesting against the government, I mean, in favor of the government, for why the government is not harsh enough against these people who have killed or blown up, literally calling them terrorists. So dispense with the idea. There is nothing. The narrative that you see in the Western media is nothing, not even a grain of truth in it. Certainly, there are some pockets, particularly in Kurdistan, which is the western side of Iran, regarding some issues that they have, but it's blown into disproportionate way, in a disproportionate manner, that it is now the end of the Islamic Revolution. The government in Iran is as strong as was before. This is simply another glitch, what we call the velvet attempt to create a velvet revolution in Iran, which has failed in the past. The case of Imami, which you mentioned, Rob, again goes against the facts that are available. Let me digress a little bit. Those people who are living in the West and are not in favor of the Islamic Revolution or the government in Iran, they fabricate things and they create some kind of, they construct this image that the regime is falling apart. And this is not new. I'm sure you remember 2 years ago, 3 years ago, during 3 years ago during Trump's time, the security advisor with the Munafiqeen and others, they were saying that within 6 months we will be celebrating in Tehran. So the wish and the demand that the Islamic Revolution is going to fall and a Western supported or orientated regime comes to power has been there since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution 43 years ago. This lady that died, the facts are quite clear that she did not die because she was beaten up or tortured by the government. The fact is something about her own previous life. She was a member of a Kurdish terrorist organization called Kumala, which they are working in the northern Iraq, supported by the Israelis, by the Americans, and everybody else, by the British Secret Service, trying to infiltrate Iran and topple the regime, or at least create havoc by blowing up infrastructure in Iran. So her pictures, as part of this group, were all over the newspaper. Her family supporters clearly indicated and stated that she suffered a pre-existing condition, including surgical removal of brain tumor, etc., etc. So if she died, which Iranians were very quick in sending these pictures out, she died not in custody. She went to visit the office, and after talking to a few people, simply collapsed on the seat, which clearly indicated that it was a seizure, and seizure led to heart attack. They used this as an excuse that Iranian regime has tortured her, etc., etc. This is a non-existing reality that these people talk about. There is no, certainly the economic condition and social condition in Iran due to 43 years of embargo has resulted in a, relatively speaking, huge amount of discontent, particularly within the youth who find it very difficult to find a job, inflation and et cetera, and other economic conditions affecting their lives. They come out of university and they don't have a job or, lined up or prospect of a job. They can't get married because of the economic circumstances. This has led to a section of the society to rise or at least express their discontent against the economic and social conditions that exist, but not to the degree that the West has presented it. I remember as I got to Iraq, BBC was reporting Iranian in the Farsi section of the BBC was reporting that there was a huge revolt by the lorry and the semi-truck drivers blocking Tehran and other major cities. I did not see anything of the sort. I visited most of these sites that they were talking about it, and people were lining up for gas, certainly, but nothing blocking of highways in the way, say, they do it in France, Germany, or something when they want to express against a particular government policy. So the Islamic Revolution, from what I saw during these 4 weeks, and I deliberately decided to speak to both what we call religious scholars, both call it conservative and non-conservatives, by talk to the youth as well as others, and they all said the same thing. They admit that there are crises due to economic circumstances, but not to the level that is being presented in the West as if somehow a revolt, a revolution against the Islamic Republic. It's nothing of that sort.
Ibrahim,
yes.
A question on this. So what you're basically saying is that there were protests, but the scales were much smaller and much more localized than portrayed in the U.S. media.
Certainly, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't see anything in Iran, in the northern cities such as Mashhad and other places that I visited. And I didn't see anything in the southern part. Major cities, I did not see any protest at all. There is certainly news of some kind of protest in the Kurdish region on the western side of Iran, which is to be expected because of the infiltration by the Kurds in the northern Iraq. But certainly this is not to the scale that they are talking about. It's not a revolution. It's a media disinformation rather than fact on the ground.
Oh, hey, Ibrahim, just a quick question. You know, what we're getting here in the media, as you might be aware, in the U.S. media, is women who are protesting having to wear the hijab and other cultural there's like a cultural police that make sure that women are dressed a certain way and whatever. And the way it's being presented in the U.S. media is that women are protesting the having to wear, the hijab, things that they would not, you know, they want to dress more Western is what we're being told.
Jim, in any society, there are what we call stratas of population with their own ideas. Wearing of some kind of, that's the hijab that they talk about, they really don't understand what's going on. Iranian, because of Islam, requires women to at least be modestly dressed. That is the only thing that the government in Iran is expecting them. If they see signs of what they call immodesty, where women are not wearing proper or observing proper code of dress, they are being reminded. There is no police or anything. They will be asked to go and report to what we call an office, that they will be reminded for that there is this idea of being modestly dressed is mandatory and you have to follow it. Unlike, for example, what we have in Saudi Arabia, where the police is part of the police, that they beat people up and imprison and lock people up. Not in Iran. I went to northern Tehran. Northern Tehran is a place normally for more westernized and orientated families, and hardly anything one could, even as far as modesty, Islamic modesty existed. But nobody came and stopped them or talked to them or beat them up or took them to the police station. a strata which considers itself westernized, and they are not in favor of any kind of Islamic law or Islamic obligation, mandatory rule. Certainly, they find it either difficult or they try to find an excuse against it. But just look at millions of people within the rallies in support of the government, where women are wearing full mandatory cover and are not objecting to it. So I'm not saying that all the women in Iran are in favor or they are in support of observing these codes. What I'm saying is that huge number, majority of women in Iran, they follow it. For example, I went to Mashhad, a holy city. In Mashhad, I saw women without any cover at all. And there was nobody telling them, as long as they did not come close to the holy sites, to the shrines. Once they got close to the shrines, there were individuals reminding them that, look, if you want to go inside, you need to observe this mandatory code of dress. But outside, in taxis, in buses, these are in major cities. Girls, women, even in Qom, I saw people, which is the heart of the religious scholars. There was nobody around, call them quote unquote police, to capture them, torture them, or beat them up. These are fiction. They are sitting on some kind of seat chairs in, say, California, Los Angeles, and they are making these things up. That revolution is going to fall tomorrow. Revolution is continuing. The Islamic government is as strong as before, probably stronger than 2 or 3 years ago. And these kind of glitches and hiccups exist in any society as we have it in our society.
Ibrahim, I want to ask you another question that's come up. So one of the things that the media here in the United States has mentioned, they speak about the execution of a protester in Iran for, quote, rebellion against God or sedition. And then I read recently that this particular person who was executed was a convicted murderer who killed two and stabbed others, several other people. Do you know about that incident that I'm not speaking of?
Yeah, during the early part of the rallies, that what we call... I'm sure you're familiar with the term, agents provocateurs, moved in and started not only destroying infrastructure, attacked police and local gendarmeries and others, and actually killed them. Now imagine somebody in United States, for me in Michigan, attacking a police, two or three police stations, and burning it down. And the police, as they come out, these police officers are attacked and killed. What the government is going to do? They're going to sit back on their backside and do nothing?
You know, it reminds me of what we saw in Syria. That is to say, legitimate grievances, not so much wanting to overthrow the government, but that the government address certain grievances. And so you have a movement of some kind of social reform, if you like. And then that movement is infiltrated and co-opted by these outside elements, whether they're supported by the United States or Saudi Arabia. And once again, this is, I'm wondering if we're not seeing the same thing here in these recent demonstrations in Iran.
Certainly. I mean, there are infiltration. There is not a day where the government... Let me just first say this, and then I move to another point. Rob, I was there in Tehran when Ayatollah Khamenei gave a speech, and he said that he has received huge number of letters from ordinary people as to why the government is so lenient against these people who have burned infrastructure, killed people on the street, police officers, and innocent people. He said, I am concerned that both sides are Iranians. Both sides are part of the population. are we going to open the door of Iranians killing Iranians for whatever reason? So he was hesitant to even allow the police and others to immediately take these people to court and execute them for killing other people. And then the people we come to the West and we hear about this kind of the narrative of the government is killing them for against God. There is nobody. People, I actually saw on the street of Tehran as I talked to youth, they said, we don't believe in God. Nobody has anything to do with them. In taxis, said, God is no longer an issue for us. What matters at the moment is socioeconomic conditions. Nobody is there. In the West, they try to fabricate these kind of, that this is a revolt against God, and hence the government is killing them. If the government is taking anyone to court and after trial establishes that they have killed someone and or harmed something or burned the police station, burned hospitals, and so on, then naturally they have to pay for the crime that they have committed. That's the case.
Yeah.
That's why we see this constantly being drummed about that Iran is killing this. During the time that I was in Iran, while the West was talking about this one person whom revolt against God, Saudi Arabian government killed at least 22 people by sword on a public highway, and nobody. Nothing. We didn't hear anything from the West criticizing it and talking about human rights.
Yeah, that contrast is quite striking. I want to shift the gears a little bit because most of these programs, what we're looking at are geopolitical developments. So one of the things that came to my mind is just at the time that we saw this, whatever it was, this outburst. Over the jihad was also a time where Iran was cementing its relations with China and Russia, and I'm wondering if there's some connection between yet another, if you like, colored revolution or attempt at a color revolution, as they're referred to in Iran, and Iran's moves to strengthen its position, its relations with China and Russia. Is that taking things too far?
No, you are going along the right path here, Rob. Iran, the Islamic Revolution, has never been forgiven by United States and Western powers since its beginning 43 years ago. Because of the unique Iranian position geopolitically and regionally, and everything else, no analysis of Iran or Iranian affairs should take place without being mindful or contextualizing it as part of American foreign policy and the plan that the United States has. United States has constantly talked about Velvet Revolution, Green Revolution, Red Revolution, and so on, against the Islamic the Islamic regime or the Islamic government. And nothing pleases the United States more than the fall or at least weakness of the Iranian regime or Iranian government. At the same time, the Iranian government is well aware of their precarious situation vis-a-vis the West, so they are strengthening their relationship with the East. We have talked repeatedly, Rob, I'm sure you remember, and Jim as well, about the relationship between how Iran, after realizing that there is no hope as far as nuclear deal between United States is not prepared to negotiate and agree to the terms and conditions, the Iranian leader said, forget about the United States, it cannot be trusted. The Western governments are simply puppets of United States. They will not adhere to the terms and conditions. We have to turn eastwards. Turning eastwards meant strengthening the relationship between Iran and China and between Iran and Russia, the two major powers in the region. And we have seen repeatedly, or we have heard quite a lot of the economic as well as military and other deals that have been made, agreement between China and Iran to the tune of 250, some people say 350 and more, or $500 billion for a number of years. Chinese investment in Iran has increased dramatically. They are helping with the infrastructure such as trains, building roads, fast trains coming in, connecting routes from the north to the south, because ultimately China intends to connect all these countries to its Silk Road, which comes out of China and connects to these countries. So Iran has no other alternative but to strengthen its relationship with China and Russia.
Okay.
The same deal are being done with Russia.
Yes, I want to add something here that in connection with this demonstration. So one of the consequences of the way the media portrays what's happening in Iran is that Iran's position in the Middle East is weakening, and that this is an example of it. And yet, you know, in our discussions, what it seems to be quite different, that Iran's position in the Middle East is strengthening. So what's the deal? Is it weakening or is it getting stronger right now?
Rob, a few minutes ago, I indicated the impression that I got by looking at how the Chinese are working with the Iranian government. The Iranian government's role in the region, particularly after joining the Shanghai Council, it's much stronger than before. They have developed now the embargo, the so-called oil embargo and so on, is not working against Iran. Iran is at liberty to not only develop oil and gas fields, they are selling them outside. Chinese are buying, other countries are buying from, Russians are buying, other countries are buying from Iran. So economically, Iran is in much better shape than, say, Iran was in 2015. Militarily, Iran is much better shape again than that. And the sign of the strength is that they can bomb American building that the Israelis are using in northern Iraq as a center for infiltration into Iran. And the Americans have no, they cannot even, after admitting that that section was used by the Israelis, they will not be able to do anything against Iran. That's a sign of power. Yes.
I just want to jump in here real briefly, Ibrahim. I want to remind the listeners, we're coming up to the bottom of the hour, 6:30, and they're tuned to KGNU. This is Hemispheres, and this is the Middle East Dialogues. I'm your host, Jim Nelson. And joining me, as always, in these conversations are Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince. And we're discussing Ibrahim's recent trip to the Middle East, specifically Iran and Iraq. Go ahead, Ibrahim. I cut you off.
Well, there. Yeah, I want to throw in another question here about some recent events.
But so, Rob, before you go on.
He was making a point.
Okay, yeah. Fine.
Before you go on, let me just finish it. Just a reminder to our listeners that Iranian relation with China and Russia didn't start during this so-called uprising or revolt. Iranian relationship with China, economic, social, and militarily, at least one could trace it back to 5 or 6 years ago, where it was openly talked about, and Iran became an observer member of the Shanghai Council, and then finally joined the Council fully. So it's nothing new for the Western, I know Western media is trying to present it that way, or portray it that way, but Iran's relationship with China and Russia has been going on, established for at least 5, 6, 7 years, Nothing new about it. So this is another misinformation. Go ahead, Rob.
And I just want to jump in and say that people that have been listening to our program would know that China and Iran have been in discussion, and that the Iran nuclear deal had something to do with that relationship and trying to divide or to pull Iran away from its move towards China, I would say so.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And
yeah.
Another way that the media and the State Department seem to trying to create tensions is to suggest that China's new relationships with Saudi Arabia is going to cause great tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Okay. And in fact, they're suggesting, as they often do, that China's visit that the Prime Minister made to Saudi Arabia, that this was kind of an anti-Iranian, if you like, slap in the face. Now, my take is really quite different about that. I see China's relations with Saudi Arabia not at the expense of its relations with Iran. And so I'm wondering if you can, talk about this a little bit, Ibrahim. Is it true that China is kind of shifting gears now and moving away from Iran and closer to Saudi Arabia? What's going on here?
No, I mean, China's expansion or expansion of influence in the region is not a mutually exclusive one or the other. Chinese are deliberately moving into the area. Even they are trying to make a deal with Afghanistan, with Pakistan, with India, with Iran, and Saudi Arabia is the latest country which is showing or giving them green light to influence. On the one hand, we have to analyze this. How comes Saudi Arabia, that was a solid base for the Americans, now are turning or giving green light to the Chinese, and they want to establish some kind of economic ties with the Chinese? Wherever Chinese go, one thing which is critical: first, naturally, they want their own interest, and they intend to secure their own interest. But the most important factor here that they think and they always try to consider is stability in the region of their influence. They want stability. They don't want to move into a country that all around it is unstable. Naturally, because there is some kind of a conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, what the Chinese are doing is not playing Iran against Saudi Arabia. What they're trying to do is pacify the Saudis and bring them to term with the idea that Iran is going to be there and Iran is not going to vanish. So the sooner they realize that reality and try to create some kind of a bridge between the two countries, the better. And the outcome of that visit, while the West is not providing this information, was Iraqi prime minister talking about that there is a possibility very soon, could be this week or next week, Raisi, the Iranian president, and Mohammed bin Salman meeting each other in Baghdad.
That's interesting. So what it looks like in contrast to what we're hearing is, again, if the main theme for the Chinese in the Middle East is creating stability, it's actually trying to reduce the tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Are there any examples at this point that we see some kind of, if you like, confidence building measure between these two regional antagonists?
Well, there was a second, they call it Baghdad Conference, which was number two, that was organized in Amman in Jordan. And Iranian representatives attended it, as well as the Saudi representative as well. The secret discussion between Saudi representative and Iranian representative to the close to the foreign ministry level has been going on in Baghdad. Baghdad is hosting these. Even the foreign minister, Iranian foreign minister, said that we have been in contact, and soon some kind of confident building measures will be starting, Iranian exchange of ambassadors, etc., etc. So all of these are clearly an indication that Chinese are trying to stabilize the region, because at the end of the day, it's in their interest. If they want to influence the region, they don't want to move into areas that are that are unstable. And the only two countries in the region that at the moment, for the Chinese, leaving the Israelis out, for the Chinese matter economically, and they are both economic powers as well as military powers, are the Iranians and the Saudis. And they want to create some kind of a relationship between these two countries that ultimately benefit the Chinese interest in the long run by creating a stable relationship in the region. And
so,
by the
way, so in this case, Ibrahim,
yeah,
it seems like it's, you know, to use an overused expression here in the United States, it's a win-win situation for Saudi Arabia and Iran, and one might add, and China. So who is losing, if you like, influence in this? Who are the losers, if one can use such a term, or maybe that's an exaggerated term, but who loses influence as a result
of
this?
Well, you just said that it's the American media that is saying it, and it's not naturally the loser in the United States, because this kind of presentation doesn't exist. In no analysis, if you read Indian or other political analysts in the region, Russian, Chinese, Indian, and others, nobody is saying that Chinese visit to Saudi Arabia is going to be some kind of a card playing Iran against Saudi Arabia, or a slap against Iran. Far, far from it. Iranian relationship with China, because of the huge amount of interest that is involved, is not, is solid, is not, nothing is going to destabilize it. At the moment, Chinese are trying to tiptoe into the Saudi affair to see the possibility of establishing a relationship with the Saudi, with the Saudis. The question then, to give you an answer, which country is going to lose when the Chinese move into an area that up to a few years ago, United States would have considered it to be its own back garden, and nobody else had the right to influence it.
Yes. So we don't have a lot of time, and it's just so much interesting information. Can you, changing the subject just a little bit, well, maybe not, because it seems to me that whatever goes on in Iran has influence in Iraq as well. Can you briefly tell us what your impressions were being in Iraq now? What are we, 19 years after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, what the situation is, both on the ground and also geopolitically? Iraq seems to be kind of caught, if you like, between a rock and a hard place from where I'm sitting.
Well, this this trip created an opportunity for me to get into areas that I were not able to visit, because it was off limit for ordinary people in Iraq, and that was the green zone in the middle of Baghdad. I had few friends in Canada when I lived there for a couple of years, representing the office of the Grand Scholar Ayatollah Sistani. And these people went back to Iraq, and naturally, because of their ability, they were able to secure very sensitive, or call it high position jobs. And they live in the middle of this, the green zone. So naturally, they invited me to go and stay with them, and they took me around. The green zone is well protected. The biggest embassy in the world is there with walled concrete that nobody, you can see only the what we call it, the satellites and so on, but nobody else has the right to go in. And the areas around, I passed the prime minister's office, I passed the president's office, etc. These people were showing me around. The green zone is well protected and well balanced, clean, and everything is working. As soon as you come out of the green zone, you are moving into a totally different world. Unbelievable poverty, unbelievable destruction of the infrastructure that has not been built properly, electricity in the middle of the green zone. I was sitting with, it was strange that we were sitting and discussing the effect of the invasion in Iraq and that the electricity was cut. Everybody has generators that within a few minutes, the generator kicks in to provide electricity for the country that during Saddam's time, and even during the embargo, people didn't have to suffer the electricity cut and water crisis and everything else. Health service is in crisis. Water treatment is in crisis. Trash and destruction is everywhere. Electricity during the day might be there, or at night might be there, during the day is not there. As we so Iraq is moving towards what Lebanon is going through today. And these people were telling us that the American representative, American politicians have made it clear that so long as there is an influence by Iran in Iraq, they would, Americans and the Western powers will not help Iraq to develop and get, stand on its feet. As a consequence, Iraq is suffering what they say that because of their relationship with Iran. The problem for the West is that they can't understand that the Iranian influence in Iraq is natural, because not only the closeness of the religious issues, etc., huge amount of services that the Iranians are providing sometimes for free for the Iraqis, whether it is medicine, whether it's doctors, whether it's mobile hospitals, etc., etc. So Iraq is in crisis and is stuck. The United States and the Western powers are not allowing it to develop, and that automatically brings it closer to Iran, because Iran provides assistance needed in Iraq, and it becomes a vicious cycle that the United States says, look, you are getting it from Iranians, so we put more pressure on the Iraqis. Iraq is in a desperate situation. Most of the oil that it produces, it cannot take. The money only partially allowed by the Americans for the Iraqi government to be able to use. The rest goes into some kind of black hole, or call it, that the Americans control. Iraqis have no influence on it. Hospitals have crisis, doctors have crisis, medications don't exist, etc., etc. So Chinese-Iranian relationship that strengthens Iranian's position naturally lead to Iran being able to influence the region around it, because it needs stability as well. But then it feeds into that cycle of violence, or at least the demand, unreasonable demand by the Americans against the Iraqi regime, that you have to cut your relationship with Iran, which is not going to happen.
So at this point, what it looks like is, well, first of all, that 19 years after this war started, there has been no redevelopment of Iraq by the United States. None whatsoever.
None whatsoever.
Right. And secondly, that that the United States is still using Iraq, if you as it has for a very long time, as a kind of cat's paw or pawn against Iran, or it hopes to be able to do that. But the situation, because of the change in the balance of power, has become more difficult. It seems like a situation that cannot last, if you like. It's unsustainable, this situation, as is the U.S. role in Iraq. Is that,
well,
again?
You see, yeah, you see, this kind of vicious cycle or circle, whatever one calls it, is leading to huge amount of discontent within the Iraqi population. And now we're beginning to get uprising, revolt, and so on the streets of Baghdad, as it happened a couple of months ago with Muqtada al-Sadr and others, that they really got close to burning Prime Minister's office, etc., etc. United States wants Iraq to be it's within the field of its own influence alone. Iraq cannot be that unless it establishes itself and becomes free and stands on its own feet. And the United States is not allowing that to happen. So by default, it's falling back into the arm of Iran, because they need Iranian support. They need Iranian influence. They need Iranian contribution to this, to the stability of Iraq. And again, we go back. I passed by train stations that they were built during the Ottoman period. Still, they were not changed. Road structure, hardly any road that you can. During Saddam's time, I used to travel from Baghdad to Samarra in about an hour. Now it takes you 3.5 hours because of potholes and roads that are not, it's not only filthy, they are, you cannot drive on them. And this is 19 years after so-called liberation and invasion of Iraq. With huge amount of money that they get from Iraqi oil and Iraqi gas. Iraq doesn't have electricity. If it wasn't the electricity being provided by Iran, Iraq would have been in darkness at least 10 to 12 hours a day.
So the same way that the United States leaves Afghanistan and just hopes that what's going, basically leaves it in such a way that it's going to create chaos for a very, very long time, without any sense of responsibility for the harm that it's caused, both human and infrastructural. Essentially, we're seeing a replay of that in Iraq.
It's exactly the same. It's not only a replay, it's exactly the same. I passed by between Najaf and Karbala, and between Karbala and Baghdad. I passed by areas that the United States had kind of crushed its own vehicles so that the Iraqis don't use them, and simply dumped them on the side of the road with water and everything else leaking into, with all the chemicals leaking into the water table, and then that water table being used by people. And then the people complain, why is it that they have so much sickness, so much disease, so much crisis, health crisis, because of all these. And these are thousands of these sites all over Iraq.
Jim, do you have any questions that you want to throw in at this point? We're getting near the end, I believe.
I have a question about just that, well, Ibrahim did touch on it, the destruction that has happened in Iraq. And maybe he could go in a little bit more detail on if you are, Ibrahim, aware of the fact that the U.S. was going, they claimed, when they left Iraq, and since then they've been saying they're going to develop the oil so that Iraq can redevelop and so forth. But as you're saying, the money is not going back to Iraq. It is somehow flowing into the U.S. coffers. And I just wonder how that deal has progressed, or how that was perpetrated on the Iraqi government, and how does the Iraqi government let that happen or let it exist?
Jim, the Iraqi government is a government on paper. In reality, it doesn't have any power. The prime minister, prime minister just before Khatami, the one before it, made a deal with China, $500 billion for development of infrastructure in Iraq. Within 24 hours, he said it himself in public radio and public TV. Within 24 hours of coming back to Baghdad after that deal, he received a warning from the American ambassador that either you negate the deal or we will topple you.
Right.
He insisted on keeping the deal with it immediately the day after. The streets of Baghdad and Najaf and everywhere else, we were rallying until he was stopped.
And you know, Ibrahim, you know, we've been doing this program for a long time, and you have gone back to Iraq in the past, and that from your last visit to this visit, what did you perceive, or you know, what were the conditions? Have they improved at all, or
at all?
Are
none
things,
at all. None at
yeah.
all. I passed. I mean, the roads that used to be at least manageable, or you can drive on them, 4 or 5 years ago, because of lack of maintenance and so on, it's become so bad. Trash and hygiene is non-existent at all. I have pictures taken of hospitals, nearly close to the hospitals, piles, religious sites, shrines, piles of trash all over. It's just not just close to the door. The stink and of these rotten stuff. For the first time, I could see on public view wild dogs running around because of the trash, and there is nobody to control them.
Wow.
Yeah.
And like Rob said earlier, this is maybe the fate of Afghanistan. Not maybe, probably. And it's just a sad commentary on the United States. And
Libya and Syria and who knows how many other places.
You do mention. Yeah. Thanks, Rob. That's very, very true.
One thing, because we don't have much time, but that I would. When you raised the question, Ibrahim, of or Jim, about the oil,
yes,
actually, Ibrahim, the Iraqis really don't control their own oil. It's controlled by foreign multinationals now, which was one of the goals of this invasion in the first place. Is that accurate?
Yeah, they don't control the oil. The oil is in the hand of American multinational companies, and they are given pittance of that oil for the basic things, I suppose. But the rest, they are not the rest of the money. The Iraqis don't see it, so that they cannot use it for building infrastructure.
Okay.
Well, I'm gonna end it here, gentlemen. I think that's all the time we have for this evening's program. I want to thank Ibrahim Kazrouni, and I want to welcome him back. And I'm glad he's safely returned back to the United States. And of course, Rob Prince for recording this program, and for both of you bringing the KGNU listeners an update on recent events in Iraq and Iran. And thanks again for giving the listeners a perspective and analysis of the Middle East not often heard in the corporate mainstream media. And if you would like to comment on this evening's program or any program you hear on KGNU, you can always call the comment line 303-447 9911. Again, that's 303-447-9911 to call the comment line. And I want to thank the listeners for tuning into Hemispheres this evening. I've been your host, Jim Nelson. Tune in next week for another edition of Hemispheres. Please stay tuned for Cabaret.